Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Tuesday, May 22nd, 2012 Harbor Board of Aldermen meeting. This is a public hearing meeting, so we do not normally take petitions from the public on these nights, at least not on matters that are other than on the agenda. All right, so I believe that brings us directly to item A1, public hearing on Safe Routes to School Action Plan. Mr. Manager.
Okay, Mr. Mayor, Jeff Brubecker will present the staff report on the Safe Routes to School Action Plan.
Thank you. This is the opportunity for a public comment on the Safe Routes to School Action Plan. This is an action plan that's been in development since 2008 when the service award was awarded by NCDOT. And over the last couple of years, we've really had a dynamic and comprehensive process for developing Safe Routes to School recommendations. I'm proud tonight to present the plan to the board. So the purpose of the Safe Routes to School program is threefold. One, it's to encourage kids to walk and bike to school, including kids with disabilities, to make walking and bicycling safer and more appealing, and to implement projects that will improve safety, reduce traffic, fuel consumption, and air pollution around schools. There's several benefits of walking and bicycling to school. I don't think these need to necessarily be articulated. A lot of them are self-evident, but certainly, physical activity benefits, and the potential benefits of physical activity and school performance, as well as potential effect on transportation service costs to the school district. So where are we at today in terms of walking and biking to school in Carborough, at least for the two schools that are included in the action plan, which I'll talk more about later? First school included is Carborough Elementary, and what this chart shows right here is percentage of kids who walk and bike to school. Each set of columns represents a different count period from spring of 2009 to fall of 2011. And these horizontal blue and red bars represent the national average. So the national average is about 13 to 16% of kids walk to school, and the national average is about 2% of kids bike to school. So you can see right here in Carborough Elementary, depending on the time of year, they range from about 6 to 10% of kids walking to school, and anywhere from very few in the winter time to about 4% of kids cycling to school, although I will have more good news on that later. And this is McDougal Elementary. You can see the same national averages here. And McDougal's about 6 to 12% walking to school, at least for the times that we measured, and they're about 2 to 7% biking to school. So McDougal is above average in terms of kids who bike to school. And I know that there is strong programs among some parents to bike their kids to school. I've heard that there's a bike train that goes to school where several kids bike together to school. So that's kind of cool. So this describes the action plan process. We started with a kickoff meeting in 2009, and we got together what we called the action plan team. The action plan team was a steering committee composed of the principals from the two schools, staff from the two schools, faculty, parents, transportation advisory board member, and then staff from the planning department of the town, the police department, the fire department, and the rec and parks department. So we really had a diverse group, came together, and it also included staff from the school district as well, transportation staff, came together and established a vision and goals for the action plan in 2009. We were working with consultants who were paid by the service award that we received to provide free technical assistance to the town. Following the kickoff meeting and the setting of vision and goals, consultants went out and they did data collection. So the town and consultants worked together to, and the schools as well, worked together to collect student travel tallies and parent surveys, which informed some of the data that we saw before. And then there were also field visits to the schools so that we could kind of ground truth conditions and what conditions were encouraging and discouraging for kids to walk to school. So we found out, the types of information we found out were really valuable, and this is kind of just one of the bits of information that we found out from the parent surveys. These are the top five issues cited by parents for why their child does not walk or bike to school. Traffic volume, traffic speed, safety of intersections or crossings, distance, and lack of sidewalks or pathways. So that really gives a good idea of where to focus our attention if we want to have more parents feeling more comfortable about their children walking and biking to school. So we also got parent feedback in terms of write-in answers, and this was really helpful because a lot of parents identified particular intersections and particular road segments that they had particular concerns about or reasons why their kid thinks it's fun to walk and bike to school. Like Mr. James, the crossing guard at McDougal, kids love him, and you know that's a fun part of walking to school. Sometimes she enjoys walking or biking. Other days she complains about it. We already have to drive to preschool, so it's easier to drop off. We need sidewalks on Old Fayetteville Road. Comments like that were really helpful in focusing where we would target our recommendations for improvements. So that was followed by a Barriers and Solutions public meeting at Carborough Elementary, which had about 50 attendees. It was well attended, and we got really good recommendations. We sent out a newsletter concurrent with the advertisement for the meeting, and you know we got parents and kids even in the room to look over maps. And you know this is a very typical planning exercise: look over maps and write comments on the maps where they felt there could be improvements. So the consultant took all that information and then compiled it into the draft action plan that you see on the town's webpage and that you should have a CD of as well. And then we got together the action plan team again, who reviewed the recommendations in the plan and at McDougal School. And then the plan was also presented at McDougal Elementary's Fall Festival. So there was, even after the draft plan was completed, there was immediate feedback on the recommendations. And the final draft was then completed, taking into account the client review meeting, and it's based on the five E's, just like the Carborough Bike Plan: engineering, encouragement, education, evaluation, and enforcement, recognizing that no one of these alone will lead to the vision and goals that were established in the plan. So I should say at this point, this is when you all heard about the plan last, which was February of 2011. And from there, the board directed that the plan basically go on tour, so get presented to McDougal PTA, Carborough PTA, and the Board of Education for further review. And the plan was presented to McDougal PTA in February of this year and presented to the Board of Education in April of this year. Also, the plan was emailed to the Carborough PTA members. No feedback was received at this time. So what is actually in the plan? I don't have time to go through every recommendation, although I'd be happy to take questions about particular locations if there are any questions. First and foremost, the plan has recommendations for engineering improvements to make the actual physical environment safer for kids walking and going to school. So this includes new sidewalks, new multi-use paths, and repaired multi-use paths, such as the multi-use path at the end of Quail Roost Drive, and new bike lanes. It also recommends crosswalk improvements, median refuge islands, and signals such as hawk signals, which I know you've heard about before. And then it recommends on-campus improvements that would be the likely be the jurisdiction of the school district, such as covered bike parking and pavement marking upgrades to make crosswalks where kids are crossing in the parking lots of the two schools more visible. Mm-hmm. And then it also recommends traffic calming. So refuge islands, which serve both as pedestrian safety measures and traffic calming measures, curb extensions, chicanes or speed tables, and the Main Street Road Diet, which you're familiar with through the town's separate process for that project. So that's the engineering side. There are also chapters in the plan on policies and programs. And the main policy recommendations for the town of Carrboro included in the plan include adopting a complete streets policy. Now, the town has had the town's land use ordinance basically has a complete streets-like set of recommendations for our roads, but the plan felt that it could be bolstered by a more cohesive complete streets policy. It also recommended exploration of whether a portion of traffic fines in school zones could be directed for safe routes to school programs and infrastructure. And then it also recommended enhancing the sidewalk policy and require that more arterials have sidewalks on both sides of the road. There's a lot of arterials in the sidewalk policy, which was adopted in 1989, only require sidewalk on one side of the road. And then it also recommends top priority programs such as education, so integrate bike ped education into the school day. Some of this is, of course, already being done by the schools, so the recommendation is to continue and strengthen those efforts. And then a comprehensive walk and bike to school campaign. You can see here the positive media attention that McDougal's Elementary got from the newspaper when they had walk to school day in October of 2010. So more about walk and bike to school days. The plan recommends continuing to hold these with a separate Safe Routes to School grant. The town has been very fortunate to work with Carrboro Elementary to hold encouragement events. That was what the bike safety rodeo was about, to work with other stakeholders and businesses in the community to hold critical mass events, and bike fix-it days, and, of course, walk and bike to school days. And I'm proud to say that in October of 2011, there were 33% of all kids at Carrboro Elementary either walked or biked to school. So that alone was higher than one of the main goals of the action plan, which was by 2015 to get 25% of kids walking and biking to school. So for this one day, we were at 33%, and you can see right here the bike rack is, can't even see the bike rack because it's covered in bikes. And this is a new bike rack that was recently donated to the school by a parent who heard about the need for a bike rack at Carrboro at our bike safety rodeo. And that bike rack is just in time because it's also covered in bikes. So you know, this shows the power of what encouragement activities and walk and bike to school days can do. Walking school buses are very important. Parents may say, well, you know, I'd love to have my kid walk and bike to school, but I don't want them to do it alone. Walking school buses is a way for kids to do it in groups and for the chaperoning responsibility to be shared amongst, you know, amongst parents in a neighborhood. So that was popular at the walk to school day that we had at Carrboro Elementary. These kids are proud that Spring Valley walks to school, so they had some neighborhood pride there.
We could walk Spring Valley.
Yeah. So they look kind of tired. But we won't comment on the spelling of Valley next time. But So the it also involves the action plan's recommendation also involves expanding the crossing guard program, and this is something that would be likely be the responsibility of the school district. So you can see here there are multi-jurisdictional recommendations in the plan, and also it involves law enforcement techniques such as ticketing, speed trailers, and so forth. And I know the police department has already been doing some of that with their pedestrian safety campaign that they had in 2010. And then finally, the last chapter of the plan recommends quick ways to begin implementing the plan, and it has a comprehensive table of recommendations. And key among these is establishing a Safe Routes to School implementation and advisory committee. That would be the shared responsibility of the school district and the town of Carrboro. The plan does recommend that it be mutually adopted by both the school district and the town of Carrboro. One of the natural outcomes of that would be a committee to work on implementation that would be a collaboration between the town and the school district. And so that kind of summarizes the plan. Of course, in your packets, you have three advisory board recommendations. Two should have been included in your packets, and the Greenways Commission just had a recommendation last night, so you should have received that at your places.
Yeah, what was the thrust of the Greenways Commission recommendation? Because I haven't looked at that yet.
The commission recommended endorsement of the plan, but he had some comments about expanding the plan or expanding future Safe Routes efforts. Yeah, I've got it here. In future Safe Routes to School planning, consider that other schools, Morris Grove Elementary School, Carrboro High School, and Elementary School 11, have been or soon will be added to Chapel Hill Carrboro City Schools system and will benefit from greenway access. And then it will be important to identify opportunities for collaboration with the town of Chapel Hill to develop safe routes, including greenways to schools that are located in the town of Chapel Hill but attended by Carrboro residents.
All right, good points. Very good, then. Is there anybody who came to speak on this public hearing? I don't have anybody signed up. But. All right. Oh, yeah. Sorry, I didn't see your hand. Come on up, James.
It's been a few years.
Mm-hmm.
I'm James Detta Bedford, member of the school board, and just want to say that we very much appreciate this plan and anything that we can work together to improve safe routes for children to walk or bike to school is just a win-win. So we're dividing and conquering because the county commissioners are having a hearing on the budget tonight, so others would have been here. Thank you.
Thanks, James.
All right, hope you have the same luck in Hillsborough. All right, are there any questions for the staff?
Yeah, Jeff, do you think that it makes sense for the advisory board to be created before the elements are prioritized for implementation? Is that kind of...
I think that would be up to the board as to the timing of creating the advisory committee for implementation and prioritizing the projects.
Okay.
The plan itself doesn't specifically prioritize the infrastructure projects. It's a simple list of projects.
Uh-huh.
Some of those projects are being are moving forward already through separate processes. The Main Street Road Diet, Pine Street Sidewalk, for instance. And looking into traffic calming on Hillsborough Road, I think that would be a decision for the policy making bodies, the board, Waldeman, and the school board, as to how best to sequence that.
Is there a recommendation for the composition of the advisory board? I don't recall seeing that.
Yes. Let me see if it says that the lead agency would be. Let me see if I can zoom in on this here.
Mm-hmm.
So the lead agency would be the Action Plan Steering Committee, and then the support would come from the Town of Carrboro, the Chapel Hill, Carrboro City Schools, NCDOT, and active parents and residents.
So it would be the existing steering committee would then continue in that function?
I think that would probably be up to the board and the school board as to who would compose that committee. I think in general, typically, you know, the board is the entity that appoints that makes up the makeup of a committee.
So we have a resolution at some point later on.
We do, yeah, and I'm trying to get it, you know, where we want to. It has place to include particular next steps, mm-hmm. and it seems like establishing that committee or advisory board is kind of key.
Well, but my point was bringing back a resolution establishing that committee.
Right, that's right, yeah.
Right, is what that is the
yeah,
shape of that.
Exactly.
Okay. Sam?
I just wanted to comment, and I had a question. It was surprising to me to see how far below the national average we are for walking to school, and so I look forward to ramping it up, and I'm very excited about this plan for that.
Can I ask why that's surprising?
Because I've always thought we are very much attuned to
walking.
Fitness and walking and bicycling.
Okay. Well, I guess, you know, there are like tens of millions of kids who live in dense urban areas where they almost have to walk.
Right.
Or bike,
right? I thought we were progressive enough that we would have
okay.
been
anyway,
on par with those.
Because that's something that struck me.
We're progressive until the morning schedule.
Yeah.
Right. That, you know, that struck me when I saw that chart is that, you know, we don't really have the context for evaluating that. We don't know, like, what an average distance to school for the kids is in those, you know, nationally or even within Carrboro. So it makes it impossible to, from my perspective, to understand that comparison. But go on.
Yeah, no, I agree. But it was also interesting to see how it's changed over time so that we certainly have diminished given the radius for walkability and bikeability. We've dropped significantly since the 60s. So there's a huge opportunity for improvement, even given that we're very suburban. The question was, what's the process for including other schools? I know we got an email asking about Frank Porter Graham, and then the Northern Greenways Commission made that recommendation that we have future planning consider these other schools that are coming online.
Yeah, I'd be happy to answer that. So the very briefly, the process for selection of the schools, since folks may wonder why these two elementary schools and not others, the Federal Safe Routes to School program only applies to grades K through 8, and the application was for this service award, which the town received, was submitted in January 2008. Morris Grove was not open until fall of 2008. And the application was specifically for the 1-2 schools category. So I don't think anybody would say that Safe Routes to School isn't important for, you know, those other schools. I think everybody would agree that needs to be looked at for other schools. It was just the logistics of the application for why these two schools were included and others weren't. I think as it turns out, the town has a lot of non-Safe Routes to School projects that happen to be within the close vicinity of other schools and serve to benefit the option of walking and bicycling to school for those schools. For instance, those schools that are within the town of Chapel Hill's limits but still are attended by kids who live in Carrboro.
Frank Porter, for example.
In this discussion leading up to this, or maybe in the discussions afterwards, I think it's important to consider the whole family, because one reason that kids don't walk to school is that you drop them off at school on your way to work, and it's quicker to drop them off at school on your way to work. So where I'm going with that is little things to look at, like does the public transit system, is that schedule in sync with the school schedule. So if you're walking your kid to McDougal, does the bus come by at a time that would you wouldn't have to wait too long to get to the university? Mm-hmm. You know, so that so if we look at like the whole family transportation issues as we're considering it, because sometimes there are hidden barriers that that nobody ever thought of, such as that. You know, so I think we need to pay attention to those as well.
That's a good point, and I know that the student travel tallies did include public transit separated from school buses. As do you use this mode? I know the numbers are pretty small, but there certainly are some kids who do you take the Chapel Hill Transit bus.
No, I'm thinking of the parents.
Oh, the parents. Okay.
So if you live in the McDougal area and you want to walk your kid to school, but then you've got to get to the university or the hospital or meet up with the TTA, does the public transit bus that the parents will need, is that schedule in sync with when you would be dropping your kid off at school?
Got it.
So for it to be as convenient in as many ways as possible, I think.
So, Jeff, is the Safe Routes to School still an active grant program, meaning do we have the opportunity to apply for future grants for the projects at the other schools?
I think we've heard that there may be another call for projects, but that's not guaranteed. Obviously, some of the funding for this program is dependent on congressional actions. So we're going to definitely wait and see and jump on any opportunity that comes out in terms of a Safe Routes call for projects.
Thanks.
Great. All right. Anything else?
Just very quickly for the public's benefit, just wanted to contextualize the potential we have because there's a lot of good information in here. But I found that the percentage of students living within 2 miles being 21%, and that in 1969, almost 90% of kids living within 1 mile of school walked or bicycled. And then looking at the national average, 1969.
That's Jackie's fault. You know, she was on the board through all the changes.
Yeah, I did that while I was in middle school. I got on the board.
Before Swan versus Mecklenburg.
That's right. Are you done?
Mm-hmm.
I know this was an awful lot of work, and it's one of your major projects. Thank you. It's a mm-hmm. really nice report, and it, as Sammy said, it gives us food for thought on other kinds of issues as well. So thanks for your work on this.
And if I could, I'd like to take a moment to thank the principals, Emily Bivens and then Petrinia Walk-McDowell, the assistant principal at McDougal, as well as faculty and staff from their schools who really helped guide the plan, as and town staff as well, too.
Thanks, Jeff.
So I would like to move the resolution, including the staff bring us back a resolution appointing the current steering committee as the ongoing.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All right. All those opposed, matter passes unanimously. All those item A2 is a public hearing on the PTA thrift shop conditional use permit.
Hey, Mr. Mayor, Jeff Cleveland.
This is very nice, yes.
Do you solemnly swear or affirm that the evidence you're about to give is the truth to the best of your knowledge?
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Here we are to review the PTA Thrift Shop Redevelopment Conditional Use Permit. Here's the vicinity of the site. You'll notice that the proposed redevelopment takes up two additional new parcels. In general, a few things to discuss. This is in the B1G zoning district, and it's also in the Downtown Neighborhood Protection Overlay District. One thing interesting about the B1G is that it has some language in it that talks about hours of operation. And so the board has the ability to limit hours of operation. And so that's something we may want to discuss later. The DNP overlay zone, as it pertains to this site, takes up a 50-foot band in the back of the property, and that regulates some architectural features, height and the amount of run that's allowed, the massing of the buildings. So let's move on a little bit. There are about 1.4 acres of combined properties, the existing buildings a little bit under 9,000 square feet. The proposed buildings, which will be two, is a little bit over 26,000, well, about 26,611 feet. Now, speaking of traffic impact, it's thought that the 59 trips will be happening in the morning hours and 112 in the evening hours. It doesn't exceed roadway capacity. The project has NCDOT approval. And there's some changes to the layout, the existing layout, that we can talk about later. As everyone knows, it's adjacent to every pedestrian facility known to man.
So I have a kind of picky question.
Yeah.
How is it that so many more enter than exit in the course of the day?
That's a question for a transportation planner who was just preceded me.
That's more like a physics professor's question.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think it relates relates to something.
I'm fine with that. If we have fewer cars on the road at the end of the day, day after day, that's
good. Yeah. Okay. Like the Motel.
We'll get back to that. This is an anecdotal tale about the traffic. The operation director at the PTA has reported that the Saturday traffic is about 25% of their weekly business activity, and the other 75% is Monday through Friday, and one-third of that occurring on Monday. So that's an interesting thing to keep in your mind, because when we get to the parking calculations, the applicant is proposing joint use parking, which enables a reduction in the amount of parking, which relates to sort of the business cycle of activity. There was a miscommunication with the applicant and myself in preparing the agenda item early on. They want to pursue this list of uses. Originally, this list of uses ended up on the side of the cover sheet, where it probably should have been front and center. My apologies. But I'll discuss what this means in terms of parking. And then we can go back to this and look at each one of these up close and personal, if you like. There was a revision also in the staff report to the parking calculations because of this. And one of the things that's unique about B1G is it has the ability to change, well, there's a new different ratio for the parking in the B1G. So, for example, high volume retail in other districts is 1 to 200. In the B1G, it's given 1 to 300. Low volume retail in B1G is also 1 to 300. So this changes the ratio a little bit. In redoing the calculations, this gives you a total of 101 parking spaces. And then pursuing the reductions using joint use, you reduce it to 84. And then bicycle parking, motorcycle space, you get it down to 82. The parking provided is 68 plus one standard handicap accessible space, two van accessible spaces, yielding a total of 71 total parking spaces. And then there's 10 bicycle spaces. And we now understand that they are all covered due to a slight revision in the plans. Let's see here. In other projects that you've reviewed downtown, the consultants have come and asked for a general blanket 1 to 300 ratio for a variety of uses. And so the applicant applied that calculation to this project. And if you were to go 1 to 300 uniformly, you'd get a requirement of 89 spaces. which is significantly less than the 101. And the real point that changes here is the restaurant use. 1 to 300 reduces this amount quite a bit. So something to keep in mind. Here is a rendering of the proposed plan from high above. And I'll go into the details in an architectural sheet. Here is the elevation. This would be the elevation from coming down Main Street, looking straight on. This is the larger building, the one that's going to house the PTA thrift shop and the offices. And then this is the building for office and restaurant. Now, the in the back here, the buffer, DNP buffer, affected a small portion of the back of this part of the building on the west side, but they met the provisions of the ordinance. There weren't any issues there.
What kind of screening is called for? Are you going to get to that?
I will get to that.
Okay.
Okay, here's the plan sheet, and I'll just go over the minute details here. Here's the bikeway, and this is a lot going on this site. Here's the main egress and ingress and egress for the cars, and then, of course, the pedestrian pathway, and then there's a bus stop right over here. One of the unique changes to this site was the creation of a stem of, I believe it's 40 feet, which is an NCDOT requirement, which allows a little more stacking in this area, which should improve somewhat the situation at that intersection. The bike path, I believe, is almost exactly in the same location, but its configuration is much changed, and there's a lot of subtle detailing, and you'll want to talk to the architect and planner about this because it's quite innovative. Because you have a situation where people are getting out of their cars, and then some kid's on his fixie bike, and he's zipping down here about 45. Well, you don't want that to happen, and so there's subtle cues throughout this whole area to try to calm bicycle traffic, but also to forewarn pedestrians that there's a transition taking place. Bicycle parking is located right along here on this side, right? And then right here on this side? Got nodding heads. Good. Yeah. Excellent. This is also a unique fixture of this operation. These two trailers, one with the wheels remaining, and I believe that's this one, and then the other, which is basically a container. And you can talk to the applicant about how these work in the operation, but they're critical in their logistics. And the usual recycling, screen recycling area with pull-out bins and whatnot. What else do we have here? Is this crosswalk striping new?
Yes, that's a new crosswalk.
That's a new crosswalk, okay. New crosswalk right here. Okay, on to the next. So, speaking of sidewalks, there's a 10-foot sidewalk requirement by the land use ordinance in the B1G zoning district. And the applicant is submitted a justification as to why, in this instance, they should be allowed a deviation. And you can talk to them about their particulars, but much of it has to do with the creation of this plaza and the way this functions with the rest of the development. There's a seat wall that goes adjacent to the sidewalk, which has been widened, but it has been widened only from 7 to 8 feet. And the seat wall is a pedestrian amenity here. I believe there's a seat wall on this side, too. No?
No.
No, on this side there's a bit of a drop-off, though.
And there's a great change in steps.
So there'll be a rail.
There's a rail.
A rail there. Okay. So let's see what else we have. Going back to this. So you'll want to look at the sidewalk justification letter. This site, as you can see, requires substantial development. So a lot of the trees will be removed, 18 in total, only one of them is less, only one of them is over 18 inches. 11 existing trees will remain, and the landscape plan has numerous plantings, and there's more detail about that on the plans. They're all native, and they meet the shading requirements, and they meet the evergreen species requirements. Regarding screening, a type A screen is required along all sides here, and the only place it's not required is along the front, which is a type C screen. So this is supportive of all the additional uses that they're seeking. There isn't a conflict with the screening that's being provided. What else do we have here? Okay, this shows the trees that are to be removed and the demolition, a couple of existing houses. This is something they want to discuss with the applicant about these, and then, of course, the primary building. And the proposed landscape plan, showing all the lovely shade trees, and then mainly understory type trees are shown in the plaza. Fire hydrants located right around there. One thing that's quite unique about this site is it's a virtual neural nexus of underground utilities. So there's Owasa lines, power lines, everything you can imagine under there. So this will be a challenge during construction. Anyhow, the project has had preliminary stormwater review by the town engineer. Because it's in the B1G, a complete full review isn't required. So there is some small chance that the design could change of the stormwater system. We don't anticipate that. When I show you what they're installing, it might explain why. And erosion control is below the threshold for an erosion control permit. Let's see. Water and sewer, the utility issues are what you might expect. They're going to be running underground services to replace overhead. Outdoor lighting will have the usual full cutoff fixtures on 15-foot poles, and it meets the requirements of the land use ordinance. Refuse services are provided, and fire safety is dealt with an existing fire hydrant. Okay, so this gives you an idea of the stormwater facilities. These are sand filters, which is just a sand filter here, and this is the wet detention vault here. I believe this is also, is this sand filter or what?
Sand filter.
Yeah, so two sand filters. So this is a substantial kind of BMP, really tremendous. You could live in it. May not be so comfortable during the storm, but utilities, obviously we just did that. Here's the site lighting. Again, it meets the lighting requirements. These are the residential properties behind and to the side. And one thing that's unique in that these trailers are actually, because of the redesigned building, are being moved further downhill. So they're actually kind of descending a little lower in visibility. But that's something you may want to discuss with the applicant. Architectural standards. In the staff report, there is an error, but it's an honest error. And it came from the reply from the applicant to the downtown architectural standards. And in that early reply, they said 47% glazing was provided along ground level at the street frontage, when in fact it's 52%. And this 52% is what the Appearance Commission recommended approval of, and that's in the attachment I of your packet there. So I've included a condition that relates to this, because you'll have to make a finding if you find this acceptable. Usual thing, neighborhood information meeting was held. And then this one, this is an important one, this applicant narrative, which is attachment J. This is really worth reading. Very interesting to me because they go through all of the planning documents, and I've never seen a project like hit more of the points than this one in this case because it's got a lot of things stacked in its favor. It's like the ultimate recycling green project. But you should read that. I hope you do. And then responses to the town sustainability checklist. That's interesting as well. I mentioned the storage containers. In your advisory boards, you'll see the, I mean, in your attachments, you'll see the advisory board recommendations. And we can discuss this and put this up later if you need that. These are the conditions. One of the issues is the plan erroneously shows a 20-foot setback on the rear property line. We just need that corrected to 10 feet on the construction plans. Two is the condition related to the board finding that the parking spaces are sufficient to serve the proposed development based on the justification provided. And you should have a new justification on your table. We put those out earlier today. And that relates to the slight change in the calculations. Number three is a condition relating to allowing the deviation in the 10-foot sidewalk requirement. Number four is a boilerplate stormwater BMP condition. And number five would be the condition that allows a deviation in the glazing requirement. So what else do we have here? Yeah, I think that's it. I'll stand back here and go to the use list here. If you would like to read that a little more closely. Are there any questions?
Jackson.
You mentioned that there was a neighborhood meeting, but no outcome from the neighborhood meeting. How many people, do you know how many people attended the neighborhood meeting? Or?
No, I do not know that. This part of this project did not take place under my watch.
Okay.
But I can find that out for you.
We'll get to that.
That's okay. That's all right.
Okay. Any other questions? If not, right now at least. We're going to hear from the applicant next, and then I will call on people who are here to speak on this. Or if you're here to speak on this public hearing, could you raise your hand? If you're not the applicant, in other words, but if you're here to speak on this public hearing, could you raise your hand so I just get an idea of who's here? Okay. All right. If the applicant would like to come up and make a presentation briefly.
Interesting.
Do you solemnly swear or affirm that the evidence you're about to give is the truth to the best of your knowledge?
I do.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Barbara Jesse Black. I'm the executive director of the PTA First Shop, and as you might imagine, this is a very exciting time for us, and I just want to thank you for the opportunity to be able to tell you just a few highlights of why this is such an important project, not just for us, but also for the town of Carrboro. You know, as you look at this picture, and if you've been to our site over the last several years, you'll know that this is going to make us much cleaner. And a much better neighbor from an aesthetic standpoint. So we're really excited about that because that's been one of the things that's been really difficult for us to manage, kind of the amount of things that we get on a regular basis. So this will help us to tidy up a bit. The other thing is that it will make all of the three functions that we currently have much more efficient, which will also help with our customers. So, you know, having people be able to donate and shop in a more pleasing environment, I think also, you know, is one of those things that we're looking very much forward to. And I know that people that shop and donate with us on a regular basis are also looking forward to that as well. You know, one of the things that we hope that this will create on a larger scale, but specifically for our organization, is we'll be able to create a few more jobs in our organization. So currently at this location, we have 14 employees. Totally, we have about 28 to 30. We'll be able to add about 5 to 7 full-time jobs to our location here, which is also very exciting for us. And, you know, we serve as an entry-level position for a lot of, as an entry-level organization for a lot of social service organizations who have folks that have challenges. So we've worked with Freedom House, we work with Horizons, you know, those sorts of organizations. And for us, it's really, we're very happy to be able to create some jobs around folks that are underemployed. Obviously our main mission is to support the Chapel Carbone City Schools. And, you know, we give between $200,000 and $300,000 a year to the district schools, to the PTAs, of which there are 18 right now. One of the things that we'll be able to do with this project is as new schools come into the district, and, you know, 2013 we'll have an additional school come in. Since we support charter schools, if a new charter school comes in, we'll support those as well. This will allow us to continue to support the schools at a level that we currently are, which last year we gave about $265 to the school districts. And also it will help us to increase that support. So as new schools come into the district, we won't be diluting the piece of the pie for each school. So we're excited about that prospect of it. Of course, this with the expanded project of adding the lease-up space, it also creates an additional revenue stream for us, which can be expanded upon. And it's a, you know, even though there are some variables around, you know, lease space and, you know, how sustainable is that depending on the economy, we feel that it's incredibly sustainable just because of where we're located and the fact that we have so much foot traffic. You know, we're on a bike path. We have a bike path. We're within walking distance to, you know, a lot of neighborhoods, and we're on a bus on the bus route. All of that speaks really well for increased traffic, and so, you know, having this expanded, adding lease-up space to that will help to increase our net revenue as well, which is, you know, what we're then in turn increases our net profit. And then, you know, finally, one of the things that sometimes we struggle with, you know, we're only open until 6 o'clock, and we're not open on Sundays at all. And so, you know, I know that from a neighborhood standpoint, you know, a lot of times on the other side where Twin Magnolia is, there's not a lot of traffic during the weekend once we're closed because it's almost like there's a cutoff there. We're hoping that, you know, this project will increase some of that economic vitality and some of that a little bit more traffic in the evenings, you know, people walking around and being more lighted and that sort of thing, looking like it's more like we're open if we have a restaurant there or if we have a business that stays open a little bit later than we do. So we're hoping that there's a nice flow of continued traffic that lasts into Sunday instead of it being closed on Sunday and you're never quite sure what's happening in the back of our building, so to speak. The last thing I want to say about this is this plaza feel that we have here. One of the things that's really exciting for us is, you know, right now that where our blacktop is, which is this plaza, it sort of serves as an unintentional meeting space for people. You know, people come and hang out because we put merchandise out and that sort of thing. What we want to create with this is more of an intentional community meeting space so that, you know, instead of putting out a lot of merchandise, and we do that because we don't have the space right now, to have benches and that kind of thing so that people actually feel like it's a welcoming space instead of just some place to hang out because, you know, we want to make it more intentional, have some community art possibly, and just have kind of like the Weaver Street Auxiliary kind of space. So but that's exciting for us. We want to be able to create that more intentionally. So I'm happy to answer any questions about the two trailers when that comes up. But thank you very much.
All right. Thanks, Barbara. Thanks.
I solemnly swear or affirm that the evidence you're about to give is the truth, the best of your knowledge.
I do. Good evening, everyone. My name is Dan Jewell. I'm with Coulter Jewell Timms. We're working with the project architects, of course. Ken will be up in a few minutes to go over a couple of details on the architecture, some of the things that Jeff brought up. Also have Kevin Hammack in my office here with me tonight who could answer maybe some more of the technical questions. Jeff did a very, very good and thorough job, as usual, on a staff report, and I just want to let you all know that by the time we get in front of you, everything that we have on our plans has been so thoroughly vetted as to whether it meets your ordinance requirements and your consulting engineer's requirements and that sort of thing. We have a extremely high level of confidence that the plan that you see before you is what will ultimately get built. And Jeff has a lot to do with that, and I appreciate them shepherding us through the process. A couple of things I would like to highlight, though, about the site design and the layout before I turn it over to Ken. Jeff hit on many of those, but keep in mind that we think this is not only going to be a much better, safer, and more productive facility for the PTA thrift shop and their tenants, but also the town of Carrboro, starting with, as Jeff mentioned, the intersection improvements that we are doing up at Jones Ferry Road, including a new striped crosswalk so that folks coming down the west side will be able to use the intersection and get into the facility, easing turning radiuses for vehicles coming into the facility, and as Jeff said, a longer throat so that the cars maneuvering in and out of these first couple of parking spaces are less likely to cause traffic to back up onto Jones Ferry or Main Street as they're coming in and out of the project. Dan, I think you asked a good question a minute ago about our parking and trip generation and that sort of thing. As much as you think maybe we are building a Roach Motel in here that there's more cars coming in the morning than are going out and vice versa, that's simply because some of the cars entering in the morning are employees who are going to park the cars and leave them there all day. So that's just the morning peak hour. So fewer cars are leaving in the morning than coming in. And then vice versa, in the afternoon, there's more cars exiting because those are some of the folks that work in the facility going away. But given that, and even though Barbara talked about more traffic for the thrift shop with the growth, the increase in schools, and that sort of thing, much of that traffic she's talking about is not vehicular traffic. Fully 50% of the employees of the thrift shop either bike, walk, or use the bus to get to work. And because we are asking for this parking reduction, I'd like to further explain one of the reasons that we think it's well justified. The numbers that you have in your ordinance that allow some reductions take into account mixes of uses, which is very appropriate. But also keep in mind, this is a very downtown, very well-located site with, as Jeff said, every transportation conveyance known to man, everything but trains. Stay tuned. Maybe we'll have those in a few years, too. So there'll be a very high percentage of folks that will use non-vehicular traffic to get in and out of here, and that's why we think you can find for the parking justification. As Jeff said, we're going to be well-landscaped, particularly the area in the back, where the trailer is. That area, as he said, will actually be several feet lower than it is today. That trailer has always been there. It's been there for years and years and years, so it's not something that we're adding new that the neighbors won't know it's there, and we're actually going to make it lower below the fence than it is today, so it'll actually be even less visible than it is. One of the things that really informed the site design and the reason that we decided to go with two buildings, of course, a large building that's on top of the footprint of the existing building and a smaller building, which would be in the area where the existing thrift shop house is, the office over there, and also Freehold Land Surveyors, is that not only is there a lot going on above ground, there's a lot going on underground. There's an Owassa sewer line, a very major sewer line that runs through here that we need to respect and maintain an easement for. There's also a very major storm drainage line. Literally, the water that falls on the roof of Town Hall here comes down the street and down through this site and back out into this little ditch on the other side there. So we've had to maintain that. That's why we split the site, put the parking on either side, and put our stormwater management facilities in here. By the way, these stormwater management facilities will capture and treat every drop of water falling on the site before it goes downstream, and we've met all of your new ordinance requirements on that. One minor little tweak we did to the Greenway Trail system is that it's currently a little bit farther to the east, so there's a little bit of a kink in it before you get up to the crosswalk if you use that. So with the redesign, we've been able to align it, so it's pretty much just a straight shot now in and out of the crosswalk, so we think it's a much safer facility. Before I turn it over to Ken, One of the things that I'd like to talk about that sort of started setting up the design of the streetscape and the front and how we're addressing the plazas and the sidewalk is just as if there is as there are a lot of utilities going underground through the middle of the site, if you were to look at our utility sheet and the package that you have, you'll see that there's about three water lines that actually come along the frontage here that then all get tied together in several little knots. It looks worse than the plumbing underneath my 100-year-old house that's been added onto over the years and then continues on that way. So because of the location of the easements and those water lines and the things that Owosso will and will not let us do out in the front, that sort of started suggesting how we would treat the front in front of the buildings and how the buildings would address the street. And I think maybe that's a good segue into letting Ken pick up a little bit with the building design. And then when we're all finished with that, we can start answering any questions you might have. Thanks.
Do you solemnly swear or affirm that the evidence you're about to give is the truth to the best of your knowledge?
I do. Good evening. Again, nice to see you. I'm Ken Friedline with Weinstein Friedline Architects here in Carrboro. I'm happy to say when my partner Ellen Weinstein and I moved our office here about 3 years ago from nearby Chapel Hill, one of the things we hoped we would be able to do is to have an impact in town. And our firm has some history with the bus shelters going way, way back, and we've now donated that design to the town. But this is more what I had in mind that I thought we might be able to do. And it's really nice after the time we spent on this to be able to be here and present it to you. I'll go to the elevations because I think that's where you may have most interest, but I want to reiterate what Dan and everybody was saying. This project, given the constraints on the site, this project really became about this intersection and about trying to do something with a very sort of nondescript entry into Carrboro. We think of this really as kind of a gateway site, and the idea that we could stretch across basically this is almost kind of a public right-of-way for utilities, that we could stretch across it and give some terminus to where West Main Street turns or as you're coming in where it hits Jones Ferry Road. So the pairing of these buildings and that elevation that we'll show you in a minute where you see the two buildings is quite a bit different from the way it looks today. I will say a word while I'm here about this reference to the trailer and the container. There are now two trailers involved in the PTA thrift operation. They're at the level of the street because they serve the main floor of PTA. One of those trailers will go away. The one trailer that remains is a trailer that they use as a part of their continuing recycling program for clothing. And it's being dropped 6 feet because it's going to service the lower level and not the upper level. This device down here is a shipping container. It now also sits up here, and it also will be back in the corner and shielded by, this is the 8-foot screen that will be built around the dumpster. And then up on the hill, being maintained and across the back is the 6-foot opaque buffer. So that's the kind of screening that occurs in that area. And that's the 6-foot screening continues on across. Jeff, what's the way to back up?
Just go down.
There you go. The buildings, what you're seeing here is the West Main Jones Ferry elevation of the leased one-story retail building, and this is the PTA thrift building with leased offices on the top. That's leased now to the Head Start pre-K program of the school system. And then you're looking at the two elevations that face the parking lot because these are both very visible. We wanted to show you those. They're both very visible as you drive down the street. So this is the parking lot side of this building, so it's along there. And this is the side that you see headed west, so it's right there, that side. And this is the entry, actually, for the school system offices. They have their own entry to get upstairs. PTA Thrift will occupy this, and that's a sales floor and their offices. And down here, it actually is a walkout basement, is about 6,500 square feet of processing space that they now don't have. Now, there will be no sales down on that floor, so unlike now where you do actually try to buy books in the midst of all that's going on there. This will be basically drop-off processing and storage for restocking. The buildings are a combination of brick masonry and metal panels used in different configurations to kind of break down the mass. We're using two colors of brick. This is a very common red brick on what we call Building B. And this is a buff-colored, and it's a larger-scale brick. So it's called a utility brick. It's a larger scale, but that has a lot to do with the scale of the building. As you can see, when you come around the corner of this building, there's a great deal more brick, and the building starts to get big. So we wanted to keep it light and not use the dark color. The unifying thing are the red brick pavers that will be in the plaza, and they are the same color as the brick on this building. There are also unifying measures, though, to sort of help carry this across the street, and that has to do with using similar language in the canopies and the heights of the canopies, and also similar glazing systems, at least on this lower floor, to try to tie it together. The massing of the buildings, the buildings were massed to try to break down so that you don't get this long continuous mass, which your ordinance requires. So you have this, you have changes in glazing, you have step backs at the entry, so the building is very segmented. And then this gesture in this roof was to acknowledge the presence of smaller scale buildings at Twin Magnolias, particularly next door, where it's a two-story residential project. And this just allows us to bring that roof down a little bit rather than have it be kind of up here and come on across and sort of stare in the face of the residences, which do face this project. So that's really what I have to say. I can say a couple of things about the bike path. The bike path, what's happened in the bike path is we're recognizing that bike traffic comes through, but at this point it's going to be increasingly a shared path, bicycles and pedestrians, and also you have people in cars, as Jeff was saying, getting out of their cars. If they're coming in to shop or dine in this building, they'll be crossing that path. So we've added bollards here and diamonds to announce to cyclists when they enter the path. That's a traffic calming measure for them. There are already bollards down here on this path, so it kind of picks that up. And then we've added a detail in the bike path, which will be at ground level, a change in pavement and marking, so that if you're getting out of your car and stepping onto that path and looking down to step on the curb, you're aware that you're entering a mixed-use zone for biking and pedestrians. There are also signs that face you several locations right here as you attempt to cross. And this area back here is where donations will be received at PTA Thrift. So that's the drive-in for that. So that's pretty much my story to tell you. I'll be happy to take questions. We have a couple of other people who we might need to ask to answer to.
Okay. Are there any questions for the applicant or for the staff at this point?
One comment from the Transportation Advisory Board was a question of less impervious surface, specifically with the plazas and the possibility of having that instead of being brick, more like those kind of like the ones that are here in the town commons. There are these
the
pavers that have holes in them. And somewhat related to that is that this is the entrance to Carrboro. One of the nice things about our area, and this being Tree City, USA, now many years in a row, like coming up Franklin Street, for example, in Chapel Hill, the big canopy trees over the streets. And you look at this area here, this is on the north side of the property, but it is on the south side of the road. And so if we could maximize shade on the road too, and I understand there's all those pipes and everything, but my question is Owassa have rules that are preventing bigger canopy trees in that area?
I'm going to ask Dan Kevin to answer that, please.
Thanks.
Yes, actually, you hit the nail on the head. Since there is a water line through there, Owassa does have a very specific list of plants they will or will not allow in the easement. And we've put, I think, the largest species tree that is on their list that we can put in there. I agree. Canopy trees, shade trees along streets are great. They make neighborhoods. So we're going to put in the biggest ones that Owassa will let us put in.
Okay, thanks. Mm-hmm.
All right.
Hi, I have a question about, I see that Building A has a sprinkler system and Building B does not, and I'm assuming that comes down to some kind of requirement, but can you explain to me why that's the case?
Building B is just such a small building at 5,000 feet. It has plenty of doors, and it's so easy to get in and out, and it's one floor, so there just aren't egress issues. I think that the town requirement for buildings over 5,000 feet, or perhaps it's 6,000 feet, but this building has been in all the designs small enough that it didn't seem like the need for a sprinkler was there.
All right. You're good, Jackie?
There were questions, I think, by the planning board about the slope of the roof, and I fully understand why you developed it like that. And then the planning board had concerns about that roof reflecting into the townhomes. Have you seen that concern?
I did. In fact, I just saw it. We've been talking about a slope roof on that project since about April, mm-hmm. and in fact, it was on the submittal. It always seemed to us like a good idea to do it. So yeah. The comment caught me a little bit by surprise. Because I understand it's not a conventional business form, but if you think about what that building does as it really steps down, I think it's a very effective thing to do to make the transition to the more suburban sort of part of Carrboro that's beyond. That was not going to reflect into those townhomes.
Okay.
The townhomes are two stories from, and that roof is above the second story and very slightly sloped. So I don't believe it's good. I don't think from the second floor windows you'll be able to see that onto the surface of that roof.
Did you, were you at the neighborhood meeting?
It was in our office.
Okay. How
16 people.
I don't see anybody here tonight, which is unusual.
I think we have somebody who would like to speak to you, too.
Oh, from the neighborhood?
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't see anybody from. Okay.
We
I mean, there wasn't anybody on Mark's sign-up sheet.
We responded by email to the 12 or so people who asked to be who asked to know when we were coming back up for a joint board review mm-hmm. 2 weeks ago. And we also met with Mr. Shipley, who's here, who asked to come to the office and see the plans.
Okay. And
one more time.
Do you remember any of the concerns of the neighbors, or
a lot of enthusiasm for what this would do to the corner and
for change?
Yeah, nice. Yes.
Well, a blank sheet kind of speaks to that. Yeah,
I would say enthusiasm.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right, great. So, was there anybody else? Is there anybody else here who wanted to speak on this public hearing before it's closed? No.
Move the public hearing be closed.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded to close the public hearing. All those in favor, seeing by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed. Motion passes unanimously. Dan, do you want to start down the sheet?
Crack into it. Move that the application is complete.
It's been moved and seconded. We find the application complete. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed. Motion passes unanimously.
Move the application in compliance with the land use ordinance.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. It's in compliance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed. Motion passes unanimously.
Move that if the application is granted, it's subject to the conditions indicated on number 3 and conditions 1 through 4 in the packet.
Second.
All right. It's been moved and seconded that it be granted subject conditions. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed.
Move that the application is granted.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded that the permit is granted. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, motion passes unanimously.
Thank you.
Congrats. That means...
That was a different experience.
I'll take more of those.
Yeah, now the other hard part starts.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
Good luck, everybody.
That's not our problem.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. It's on.
All right. I believe that brings us to item A3, which is a text amendment on that I don't understand. A text amendment I don't understand.
That's a first.
It's not a first.
You hide it well.
Good evening.
All right, let's see if we can do this in 10 minutes.
Okay. The ordinance allows payment of a mitigation fee for certain activities within water quality buffers, and the fee payment options include payment to the state's water quality enhancement fund or to payment to the town's fund. We brought the town had not yet set a fee, so we brought a proposed fee to you in April, and at that time, after some discussion, the board asked the staff to bring back a text amendment that would make payment to the town's fund the only option for impacts to a water quality buffer that were associated with an ephemeral stream. We are required to must go to the state's fund for impacts to buffers on intermittent and perennial streams, or to a private mitigation bank. There's actually those two options, but mitigation bank has to be approved by the state, but that's also a payment option. It's not exactly the sort of the fee option that, in the same manner, but it is a payment option. So the board also asked for some information on our local experience with estimating what would be an appropriate fee and possibly some alternative fee structures, and including a tiered fee. So we have prepared the draft ordinance, and it simply adds a statement that that the only payment option for impact to a buffer on an ephemeral stream is to the town's fund. It also does clarify, it has an additional sort of element in there, just a correction or a clarification of the language in that ordinance that's unrelated to the item in front of you, but it does deal with one of the other mitigation options, which is conveyance of property and the timing of when that has to happen for unsubdivided and subdivided developments. So we looked at this to try and provide you some information on what would be a reasonable fee associated with impacts to buffers. And the fee that was before you previously was the fee of 99 cents a square foot, and then the multiplier per our ordinance for an ephemeral stream, one and a half times. That's the fee that is established and updated regularly by the North Carolina Ecosystem Enhancement Program, the EEP. And we looked at costs associated with the projects that we've been doing in town, the stream restoration projects, mm-hmm. at Dry Gulch and Baldwin Park. And that seems to be a fee that covers the removal of the vegetation replacement piece. It appears that is to say the 99 cents a square foot, not the multiplier. But 99 cents a square foot seems to be the amount of money you would need to replace the vegetation in a buffer when it's disturbed. We also identified sort of another functional component of the buffer, which is the diffuse flow function. So the water comes into, hits the ground, and then you want it to flow in a diffuse manner through the buffer to whatever water channel is associated with the buffer. And looking at some sources, we were able to identify there's a pretty significant range of costs associated with the cost of building a level spreader, essentially, which is the way you maintain that diffuse flow within a buffer. And then the third element is the stream channel itself. And so we looked for costs or expenses associated with the recreation of a stream, mm-hmm. channel itself. $349 a linear foot, again, is the EEP cost for associated with that activity. So we took those numbers. Just as an aside, our local experience with the third component has lower figures. We've got $140 to $175 a square foot for the per linear foot for the projects at Baldwin Park and Dry Gulch. And although we didn't have you know, on hand the ability to actually compare line by line all of the things that were included in $349. So we don't know whether they're absolutely relevant or not, whether there's some acquisition costs or other costs that would cause that fee to be higher. So that's just information, essentially, for you to consider. Taking that that background information that we pulled together, we did prepare a resolution for your consideration, which would establish this a tiered fee depending on the amount of impact that occurred to one of these ephemeral stream or ephemeral water quality buffers. And again, we're suggesting that the removal of vegetation activity would kick in this 99 cents a square foot with the multiplier included, as is stated in the land use ordinance. If there were grading or other changes that modify the natural conditions and change the diffuse flow portion of the buffer, we've just cut the $5 to $20 took the middle of that to have the $5 to $20 a linear foot for the diffuse, the level spreader cost estimate, and they're suggesting $12.50 a linear foot, and that would be per side of the channel. So if only one side of the channel was disturbed, the diffuse flow cost would be on one side per linear foot. If both sides were disturbed, it would be multiplied by two. If it was equivalent or by the amount of on each side. And then the third component, the grading relocation and a removal of the stream channel itself, we're suggesting $349 a linear foot of stream disturbance. The Planning Board, the EAB, and the Northern Transition Area Advisory Committee have recommended approval of the draft ordinance, and Orange County reviewed it as well. And the staff's recommending approval of the draft ordinance in response to your request. For this change.
Okay, great. I don't have anybody signed up to speak on this public hearing. Is there anybody here who wants to speak on this matter? Okay. Are there any questions for staff?
You did. Thank you for all the clarifications. It really helped bring things into focus. I appreciate that.
Right, and thanks for addressing that one fund will come to our Carborough fund now. That one payment would come to the Carborough fund now.
I think I understand it now.
I don't know if I'm comfortable with getting rid of the other two options for this. I think it's valuable to have kind of that opportunity for. I mean, if we were restricting those offsetting options within town, that would be valuable easements for us here in town. But it's also served to provide perspective as for the degree to which offset funding, how it compares to what the alternatives are. So in other words, offsetting this through payments should be equitable to saving space in town for ephemeral streams. Does that make sense?
You're saying that these fees are not kind of. You're wondering whether it's consistent with the actual cost.
I'm wondering how. Yeah, two things. One, one is that we're possibly getting rid of the other two mitigation options. Is that correct?
Are we getting rid of?
No.
We're not. Okay.
So this is just
okay. Good.
No donation. Do you mean the donation?
Yeah, the donations. Those remain. Okay. Go ahead.
So those would still be a part of it.
Just the.
Okay. Good. Good. So then the question is, donations, do they compare to this mitigation option cost-wise? Is there a way of assessing that?
Well, there are criteria for a donation that are so.
Cost to developer, or you mean? Or
well, you would think that the. Setting aside or donating or putting an easement on portions that are for the purpose of stormwater runoff,
right.
That these would be comparable. So if an applicant said, instead of providing a fee, we would like to set aside X amount of ephemeral stream in X location, that would be of comparable value to what is being proposed here tonight.
But value from a sort of environmental benefits point of view, or value
value that easement represents on diminished
sort of environmental costs, services, or whatever, you know, whatever it is.
Right.
Yeah.
These requirements look pretty thorough to me. Did you have something particular in mind that you think is?
It's not specific to the requirements here listed, but rather the question of the offset fee. Is it comparable to this?
So in other words, would someone pay a fee rather than do a restoration?
Will it always be that someone pays a fee? Because
it's cheaper to do the fee. I see what you're saying. That's the question you're asking. I guess that's a situation we're going to have to kind of monitor as time goes on.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the donation of property is, you know, it's about, sometimes it's about property being available that someone has to donate that meets the criteria. So the reason there are a variety of options available is to, you know, if someone isn't in a position to have property that would meet the criteria, so that they could do something else.
So that addresses the question of options available, but not necessarily the question of will they always choose this option, because, I mean, perhaps because there's no other options available, but value-wise, or maybe those two are related.
Well, and it does say the donation shall satisfy the mitigation determination if the appraised value of the donated property interest is equal to or greater than the required fee, as determined by an appraisal. Mm-hmm. So it does give that option at the same or greater value, actually. So.
Okay, so it's contingent on that offset fee. Interesting. Right.
Okay, so is there a motion for the
resolution of consistency?
It's moved. Is there a second? It's been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Matter passed unanimously.
Move the ordinance.
Moved. Is there a second?
Second.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed? Matter passed unanimously. Aye.
Move the amendment to the fee schedule.
Second.
Been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Aye. Passes unanimously. Anything?
I want someone else to move to adjourn.
Move to adjourn.
Second. Okay. Been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Thursday.